So what I'm going to talk about today is the relationship between synaptic structure and function. And David wanted me to talk about some of the issue, to stress things that are of theoretical interest. And so I'm going to start with something that that I think is of potential theoretical interest. Now I'll tell you what it is in a second. But before I do that, let me tell you why people study synapses. There are four reasons for studying synapses, at least. One of them is, as you'll hear after a bit, that synapses are extremely useful as a model for studying cell biological systems. So there are certain processes that happen in all cells that are best studied in synapses. And so they're interesting to the cell biologist as a model for studying certain processes that I'll mention later on. That's the first reason. The second reason is that, as you'll see, synapses are not just a way of transmitting information from cell 1 to cell 2, but synapses actually process the information by filtering it. And so if you're going to understand how computations are carried out, you need to understand how synapses do their filtering. And that's actually the unsolved theoretical problem that I'm going to be talking about. The third reason that synapses are interesting is because essentially every drug that works on the mind works by changing synaptic function. Sleeping pills, all the drugs of abuse, alcohol, caffeine, antidepressants, major antipsychotics, there's no drug that affects the mind that doesn't do it by changing synaptic function. So if you're going to understand neuropharmacology, you have to understand synapses. And the final reason synapses are interesting is because we all come into biology, into neurobiology, hoping we're going to solve a big problem. We want to, you know, understand what schizophrenia is, or what intelligence is, or what memory is, or something like that. And most of these things you don't have a fighting chance for, but there is a chance to understand the mechanisms of memory storage. And it's believed that memories are stored at synapses, and so we're within shouting distance of understanding the storage mechanism. That's not going to be understanding how memory works, because that's a much bigger problem, but at least we can understand the mechanisms. So I'm going to talk about, my laboratory actually works on all of those areas, and I'm going to ultimately talk about one of the areas today, and that has to do with the dynamics of synapses, how they filter information. So here's an experiment. If you have a rat or a mouse, and you put him down on a table, and you record from cells in his hippocampus as he walks around, what you'll notice is that when he walks over to a certain place in the on the table, a particular cell will fire a lot of spikes, and if he moves away from there, it'll stop. And if he walks to another place on the table, then a different cell will fire spikes. And in fact, for every place on the table, there's some cell in the hippocampus that fires spikes. But they're not mapped out. They're not there in a nice topological way. They're not neighbor relationships that are maintained, because the cell that fires when he's on this corner of the table might be next to the cell that fires when he's in the middle of the table, and the cell that fires when he's in between may be way over there someplace. So there's no orderly relationship that anyone has discovered for these place cells firing.
But yeah. Does the sense that, well, it has this paper, that depending on the intent on the rat's movement, you actually get an order?
Maybe.
Okay.
Anyway, so as the... But as
the, so this is cell by cell or the neighborhood of
cells? Cell by cell, one cell.
Definitely
cell by cell, and the place field of the cell here and the cell just next to it are very far apart. And you can tell that because sometimes you can record from two cells on the same electrode, so you know they're neighboring cells, and one will fire over here and one will fire over there, and then there'll be some cell in a distant part of the hippocampus that fires. It's not that the hippocampus is disorderly. There is order there. So, for example, if you look to see what cell, a particular cell in the hippocampus from a different part of the hippocampus is projecting to a neuron here, then neighboring neurons get the same input from that cell. But their firing pattern is quite different. Okay, so as the animal then walks around on the surface here, he will generate spike trains, and these spike trains are very irregular. They're irregular even locally because they're very chattery, but they're long periods when the animal walks away. Okay, so here's the experiment you do. You take a spike train from an animal that was generated from an animal walking around, and you play that spike train into the same synapses, the same kind of synapses that would have seen it in real life, synapses in the hippocampus. Now, actually, as far as I know, this has never been done before. People have studied tons of inputs into synapses, but nobody has, as far as I know, has ever studied the input into a synapse in a case where you could actually study it in a way that would be, that was the natural input to see how that spike train was processed. And the reason is that there are very few places in the brain where you can get a pure synaptic input. People like me study the hippocampus a lot, and the reason is because it has such simple circuitry. It's very easy to study because you can stimulate over here a pathway and record from any cell, and it's a pure feed-forward pathway as long as you do a couple of minor experimental things. It's a pure feed-forward pathway, and you can record from any cell here and stimulate any bunch of fibers over there, and you always get the same results. And there are very few places in the brain where you can do that.
So the idea is to take the spike train, translate it into current pulses, which you put onto the...
So the idea is that you take the circuit for the hippocampus is like this. As far as it's more to it than this, but this is what we care about. There are a population of cells over here, and this is a cell body, and these are dendritic trees, and these are more dendrites, and then here's another cell next door. And there are a bunch of axons that run along like this. And you put your stimulating electrode over here, so you generate nerve impulses in these axons, and then you record initially from a population of cells over here. And I'm going to talk about this experiment twice. I'm going to talk about it once in the beginning and once toward the end. So you record over here, and you measure the average size of the response in cells over here for a natural spike train. And what you see is this. So this is the average size of the postsynaptic response of these synapses here. And these synapses aren't firing, these cells are not firing spikes, you're just recording synaptic currents. And this is the number of the stimulus in the train, 128 spikes, and this took maybe 3 or 4 minutes of the animals walking around.
You just generate the interspike intervals just come from a particular record taken from
a particular record from a real rat walking around.
Okay, but you did this experiment in culture.
This experiment was done in a slice.
So it's minus any modulators.
It's minus any. We're just looking at the pure effect of the way that synapses treat the spike train.
But not necessarily as an awake animal or things.
No, like that. Or not necessarily in a living animal, or not necessarily at a different temperature. You could change lots of variables. It turns out that as you change these variables, a lot of things. The main result isn't changed that I'm going to talk about. But I can't promise you. In fact, I'm sure that you would not get exactly the same thing had I done it in a different circumstances.
And the variability you see there from.
You'll hear in a second. Okay. Yes.
So you're measuring the cell bodies.
Yes, this is a population. We've actually recorded from single cells, and in fact from single, what we believe to be single synapses, and I'm going to show those data later. But this is just the average of a whole bunch of cells. Yeah, Barry?
It's field potential.
It's a field potential. Yeah, this is slope of the field potential. Yeah.
Why do you measure slope of the field potential?
Oh, the reason is that that when here's your shock artifact. This is voltage as a function of time, and you put your electrode down on the slice, and then you see a bunch of stuff like this. You see a thing that goes like that, and then if you change the intensity of the stimulus, you might see this. And if you measured the amplitude here, it's not changing in a very orderly way, because nerve impulses are being generated and they confuse your recording. And also, there's an there's a feedback inhibition and a feed-forward inhibition that start cutting into this. And so, if you look over here in this part of time, there's a very narrow window of time when nothing else has been able to happen except your synaptic currents. And so you measure the slope here and figure that the slope scales with the amplitude, and it does if you record intracellularly. But when people measure field potentials, they always measure this part here to avoid contamination of stuff that happens later. Yeah. Okay, so this is the result of a spike train. Yes, please.
Yeah, approximately how many synapses?
In this case, thousands. Yeah, I'm going to show you one synapse after a while, and the result's going to be the same, but it's a okay. So this looks like garbage.
Can you,
yes.
Can you just give us a scale? If I just said spike. Where would that point be on this curve, and how big would it be? An action potential waited a long time.
I'm going to show you in a second.
On that curve, it'd be indetectable.
I'm going to show you in a second.
Okay. No, each of those are ones.
It has to be
detectable. No, the field from a single synapse
would be undetectable.
Not from a single synapse.
Let me, I passionately appreciate the questions, and I really want to hear them, and it's much better if we have a conversation rather than me just kind of lecture. But let me just take two more steps, and then this is going to answer a lot of the questions, and then ask questions, okay? Okay, so because this isn't a computer, We can feed the same spike train in over and over again. Exactly the same spike train into the same synapses and record them a second time. And this looks like garbage, but when you feed the thing in twice and you plot the amplitude of the amplitude for each position down here versus the same position up there. So this is the first. This is the first stimulus. There's stimulus two. There's stimulus three. There's stimulus four. There's stimulus five. You get exactly the same garbagey response every single time you do this. And in fact, what David was asking about is, what are these air bars up here? Those air bars are not the standard air, but the standard deviation of four successive presentations of the same stimulus pattern. So what's happening is that this garbage is coming out of the synapse. This is the synaptic strength. This is the strength of the synapse with one of the phenomena that you either have or will hear about called LTP. There's in an experiment like this, there'd be like a 40% change in synaptic strength as a result of LTP in a typical experiment like this. And here, there's a two and sometimes a threefold range of synaptic strengths. So what's happening is that this synapse is, by virtue of its history, adjusting its synaptic strength constantly. It's filtering the information. And let me just show you what would happen if you just give a regular spike train. So if you give a constant frequency, this frequency here is the same mean stimulus frequency as the one over here. So you give it at a constant rate, with a mean of, say, one impulse per second, at a constant rate, and this is the size of the response here versus the stimulus number. At this point here, you switch to the mean rate doesn't change, but you just change the intervals, and you get all this garbage. And there's some transients in there too, you bet there is, because it takes a while, because some of the memories because the synapse is remembering back on many different time scales in a very complicated way. Yes?
You're going to talk about why this is downwardly biased?
The reason this is downwardly biased is because it takes a while to come into a steady state, and we were watching the steady state develop here. If you kept on going, then it would stay stable like this. So we've played these things in for...
But there's no potentiation.
There are different synapses, different slices behave different ways. Sometimes this will go up on average, sometimes it'll go down. And if you put the same spike train into different places, record from different places in the slice, you get a different pattern. It's always for one set of places, it's always the same pattern, but it's different patterns. Okay, so this is not what I'm talking about yet. This is an introduction. What this is I'm just showing you that what these synapses are doing is they are changing their strength by a lot as a result of the past history. And this is an interesting theoretical problem, I believe, because what this thing is doing is it's filtering. It's looking for something. It's going to be some pattern that gives bigger stimuli or something. And so it's an interesting theoretical problem to ask, what is this, why is this designed this way? And I'm going to talk about some of the mechanisms that underlie this. We understand them, and they're quite complicated and nonlinear. But we don't understand all of them. Yeah.
It's interesting because a simple linear model fails.
Oh, a simple linear model won't come close with this.
Okay, so it's interesting because it's a technical issue, because the inversion problem is discovering the filter out of this data. Just trying to get a focus on what's...
That is an interesting problem, and there are a couple of ways of getting at it, and we're actually trying both of the ways. Yeah. Okay. So let me just make a comment about theory in neurobiology. So oftentimes my friends in physics say, "Tell me the most important questions in neurobiology for theorists." Can't do it. And the problem is that unlike physics, where everybody knows what the questions are, they just don't know how to get the answers. Or maybe they may not pose the questions exactly the right way. But everybody knows basically high TC is a big problem. They all basically have an idea of what you have to explain, of how you have to get a trick for getting the correlations between the charge carriers. But how you do it in the right way, they don't know how to do it. That's the problem. In biology, it doesn't work that way. No one can come up to you, or rarely can they come up to you and tell me, "Here's a theoretical problem, well-posed theoretical problem, I want you to solve this for me." The second you can propose the problem, you can usually solve it. It may not do it well, but you can always do it. So when people ask, when David asked me, "Well, stress the things that are of theoretical interest," if I could pose the question sharply, then I can answer it, or you can answer it, or somebody can answer it. But doing theory in biology is especially challenging, because you have to simultaneously figure out the question and the answer. And the way I looking back at it, if you get far enough away so you have some distance. So, at the turn of the century, everybody knew about black body radiation. They knew exactly what the problems were. There were limiting theories for everything. They understood what the question was. They didn't know how to answer it. And Planck got in there, and he worked on this problem and got an answer. Okay, the genius for him was twofold. One, saying, "Okay, here's the problem I'm going to try to solve. I'm going to try to figure out this ultraviolet catastrophe." Number one. Number two, he figured out a novel way of getting of explaining black body radiation. That was very clever. He got his Nobel Prize for it, and that's what a lot of physics is like. But biology is essentially never like that. I can give you examples where it's like that, but the examples I can give you are all basically physics. They're all basically treating the physical system, a membrane, as if it's a physical system, and you can pose questions, and if you change the character of the membrane, what are you going to do to the energies of bending it or something like that? That's a problem you can pose and ask. The same time, Einstein, same time roughly that that Planck was working, Einstein was doing special relativity. That's more like the character of the theory in biology, because I don't think Einstein started with a sharp question that everybody knew. I think he was just puzzled about the implications of the constancy of the speed of light, and implications for electromagnetic theory and things like that. And he kind of puzzled and finally figured out a question and an answer. And that's more the character of questions in biology. So I believe that this thing is filtering. I believe it's looking for some special signal that it wants to give a big synaptic strength to, and other signals that it wants to give a small strength to, or minimize, or something like that. It wants to do something that you would, something maybe you'd have to calculate over time to find something out. But so I think there's a problem in there, but I don't know what the problem is. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back, and I'm going to come back to this problem later when I have told you enough stuff that we can understand some of the things that are going on. Yeah.
I mean, just to pursue this. So suppose you looked at what you might think is a simpler system. In case you knew what this, where you could control the stimulus was sort of a sensory stimulus, and you knew that behaviorally the animal responded to a certain sensory stimulus, like a set of tones. Do you find at the level of synapses like this sort of a response to action potentials that are arranged in a behaviorally relevant way, like parts of an auditory signal that's part of a bird song, mm-hmm. right? Instead of looking at the hippocampus, which is very far away from the input, that is completely internal
right.
to the brain.
Right.
If you looked at something closer to the periphery, do you see an example of a synaptic filtering?
So yes. All synapses do, in one balance or other, what these hippocampal synapses do. But the trouble is that in order to get to an interesting synapse, a central nervous system synapse, it's hard to get one where you have a pure input, where you can study one synapse or one class of synapses that are all identical. Because most places where you record, when you stimulate a simple thing and you know what you're stimulating, that, for example, you could let's look in the visual system, and what you do is you record in visual cortex, and you want to say, what are the synapses up there doing? And you show a nice simple visual stimulus. Well, it's a big mess, because any cell you record from is getting many different synaptic inputs related to the visual stimulus. Some feed forward, some feed back, and you can't isolate the effect of just the synapse by itself. So people have hardly ever this paper was published on a year or so ago, the hippocampal thing, and I looked around. I don't think anybody had ever looked at the response of a synapse. A pure synapse where they could say, I'm studying the properties of one class of synapses that are all believed to be roughly identical to a natural stimulus. I don't think anyone ever did it before. They did lots of, they put pseudo-random spike trains in or sine waves, but just didn't do it. It's hard to do because you don't have a preparation where you can do it. Okay, so is that wrong?
I take exception to your repeated assertion that it's a natural spike train, because naturally the individual cells that are those atoms are not firing synchronously. So I'm taking it's a team.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. What I did is I recorded from a population, but later on I'm going to show you data from one single synapse.
I know, and that's why I'm being quiet.
And one single synapse, except for the fact that it behaves probabilistically and not deterministically, does exactly the same thing.
That's right. So this is a special case scenario in which the synchronous inputs and the synchronous activation of this circuit does not initiate feedback inputs.
That's right.
Change the nature.
It's a cheap way of averaging across a whole bunch of synapses.
And it works here because of the unique nature of the circuit.
You're right. Absolutely. Yes.
I guess I'm also bothered because at some level, people have reported for retinal ganglion cells, and you say they're two synapses. They're funky synapses. But I mean, pretty much the response you get looks like, you know, a derivative in time. It's pretty. The filter properties seem linear and well characterized. So I'm not. I mean, somehow, this is portrayed as very, very complicated, but if I go two synapses away from sensory input.
But David, wait up a second.
I'm purposely trying to find the most complicated.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. These synapses are completely typical synapses. They're typical of what most synapses in the central nervous system are like.
It checks defense. My problem was the fact that I would say they are so simplistic. I mean, that I was.
Yeah, he says it's too simple. You say it's too complicated. But David, it's a red herring. It's a red herring. It's a red herring to say, this synapse is buried in the middle of the brain. We don't know what it's doing. Because the point is that this is the spike train that this synapse would actually have seen in real life, and it's the input spike train that a synapse like this would have gotten, and we're measuring the output of that synapse pure, nothing else in there, and we're looking at a kind of, if you will, transfer function of an individual synapse.
And so the fact that it's how disastrous even the linear model failed.
It's not even worth the trouble. I mean, we tried doing. I'll show you the kinds of models, but I can tell you why linear won't work. I mean, I know why linear won't work. I know what a lot of the components are, and they're understood. That's what I'm going to do. Yes.
So you're using natural stimuli, but what happens if you take a Poissonian stimulus? Does it really look completely different?
No, it's the same. Yeah, but if you use a pseudo random spike train or something like that, how do you know how that's related to what a synapse would normally see? How do you know?
I was just wondering whether this reproducible.
Oh, it's completely. Oh, completely. If I had put in, actually, what we did do is what we're doing now is we're going to do some. Try to figure out, treat this as a nonlinear system, kind of just figure out, characterize it in that way, doing a sort of top-down instead of bottom-up approach that you're going to hear about. And I actually lost the true spike train, and so we generated a spike train that had the same statistical characteristics as this real spike train and played it in. You can play it in for an hour. The synapses are very stable, and you can just to have data to practice on. So it's, there's nothing special about the fact this was a natural spike train, except that you know that this is the statistics that the synapse would have normally seen. Okay, so now we're going to take a step back and talk about synaptic structure. Okay, here's an axon going through the hippocampus. And is this, can people on that side see, or if they want to? Yeah, okay. So here's an axon. And here is a dendrite. And that dendrite generates a spine like that. This is a bouton. This is a spine. And on the face of the bouton opposite the spine, there is a membrane thickening and specialization called the active zone. And opposite this is a thickening of the membrane and a fuzz that's called the postsynaptic density. Inside the bouton, there are a bunch of synaptic vesicles. Some are docked onto the active zone, and other ones are clustered around back here. And these things are quite uniform in size. They're about 35 nanometers in diameter in a thick section. And they're filled with glutamate. And as you know, what happens is when the nerve impulse comes, calcium channels here open. They bind on to a protein whose name is synaptotagmin that undergoes a conformational change, permits this vesicle here to rapidly fuse. And so it goes from looking like this to its membrane fusing with this membrane, opens up, The glutamate comes out, diffuses across the cleft, binds onto postsynaptic receptors, induces a conformational change in those. They open up, ions flow through, and that constitutes the electrical signal over here. Okay, so that's the basic architecture of synapses. And the important thing that you're going to hear about is the active zone and the docked vesicles. Okay, so what this would actually look like and this is there are times when a PowerPoint presentation would be worthwhile. Okay, so can you see the little membrane thickening along here? This membrane looks a little thicker than up there. This actually was this is from culture, and in this particular case you can't see the postsynaptic fuzz very well. But here you can see the bouton. This is the dendrite. This was in culture, so there wasn't a spine. So at the age, this was done in culture. This was done for another experiment that I'll mention later on in passing. A lot of the synapses in culture don't form spines. Some do, some don't, at the age we're looking at here. And here are a bunch of docked vesicles. And up here, you can see here's the active zone, and here's a vesicle docked onto it. Can you see? And there's another vesicle that's not docked right over there. Okay, so that's what it actually looks like. Now, the synapses are not identical. In fact, synapses are extremely variable, and these are from reconstructions from serial EMs in hippocampus of synapses, and so serial sections were made. The active zones were reconstructed in three dimensions, and they don't actually have square corners like that. That's just an artifact of the thickness of the section. So we were uncertain about. You don't normally get to look down on them. You just have a series of sections, and so we just drew it like this. But now you're sitting inside the synapse. You're sitting in here, looking down on the active zone. And here are a bunch of active zones, and these little circles here were vesicles that were docked to those active zones. So what you should notice is that some active zones are very small and have only a single docked vesicle. Other active zones are gigantic, and they even have holes in them. And the number of vesicles that are docked varies from 1 to 20 or something like that. And it's very variable. So the synapses are all the same organization, but they vary a lot in size. And down here is size of the active zone in area. It says release probability, but just read size of active zone. This is cumulative probability. And you can see that there's a skewed distribution of sizes of active zones, that most are small, and there's a tail of really big ones out here. This is a cumulative distribution of active zones. Now, it turns out that the active zone does not exist in isolation, but it sits in this complex. And even though this is cell 1 and this is cell 2, the synapse itself, all around here, forms a unit. And so if you tell me the size of the active zone, I can tell you the size of the postsynaptic density. It's identical. Not only is the size of the postsynaptic density the same as the size of the active zone, it's the same shape. And so the postsynaptic density that was opposite this active zone would have had a hole in it here and a hole in it there. That's where the receptors are, yeah. There's a special protein structure, a scaffolding that holds a lot of enzymes and stuff. In this fuzz back here, this fuzz is made by a bunch of molecules that are sticking down there. And the shape of this postsynaptic density, if you look down on it, would be identical to the shape of the active zone. So what that means is there has to be communication between the sending cell and the receiving cell back and forth, because you could imagine a mechanism that would permit the active zone and the postsynaptic density to be the same size, but the same shape. There's got to be direct mechanical communication for that. Not only is the active zone and the postsynaptic density correlated in size very sharply, but the size of the bouton is proportional to the area of the active zone. The total number of vesicles in here is proportional to the area of the active zone. The number of docked vesicles is proportional to the area of active zone. The volume of the spine head is proportional to the area of the active zone. So this whole structure is a unit that has and all of its features are the same. So let's see if I. So for example, these are. This is a distribution. These things up here are just distributions of active zone sizes and numbers of docked vesicles. This is a scatter plot of active zone size and docked vesicles. So they're highly correlated. The active zone can actually fit more vesicles than are there. It has about half as many vesicles as it could have.
Chuck,
yeah.
There's a lot of variability in the size of the active zone.
Yes.
Is this a dynamic process where it's changing size with time, or is there some notion of what sets that size, what keeps it from growing?
you can change the size of it, but it takes a while. So there are procedures that you can carry out that will change the size of the active zone and the entire synapse, but it takes a few days. And in fact, it settles. If you do this procedure, you can make all the synapses grow. There's some are small, some are large, but they all get bigger. They all get scaled. That histogram would get stretched like that, so its mean would get over, but the shape would be pretty much the same. And it settles with a time constant of about a week.
And also, in the examples you had, there was no example that just had one.
Yeah.
There was?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
This one has one.
More than one.
That one has two. Sometimes you see one with zero.
How do you know where the active zone is if there's no vesicle there?
You can tell because the membrane is thick. You can see a thickening of the membrane, and it's also always opposite the postsynaptic density. And even though in the thing I showed you from culture, the postsynaptic density was not very prominent in the brain where these were taken from, it's extremely prominent. So it's not so hard. Yes.
Is there
something
more they only dock the
vesicles? I mean, what makes vesicles more docked? Yeah, it's a lot is. Actually, what makes them dock at the active zones is not known, but it's presumed that there is some special molecule that's only there, that the reason the active zone is kind of thick is because of a lot of molecules in there, and it's believed that there is some molecule that is only there, but last I heard, nobody knows what it is. But the molecular biologists have worked out a lot of the molecules that are involved in the fusion of vesicles. And a lot of people have worked on that, so a lot is known about that. Vesicles have about 20 proteins on the outside, all of which are known, and there are proteins in the membrane that they form a complex with. It's called the core complex or the snare complex, and there are three proteins that are involved, two in the membrane and one in the vesicle, that form a helical structure like that that holds it there. But that's not what tells it to dock at the active zone, because those particular proteins that form the snare complex are all over the place. But a lot is known about it. Yeah.
I want to talk also about the turnover of the system.
If you want to change its size, it takes a week. It changes its size with a time constant of a week.
Isn't there a natural process of turnover?
Yes, and I don't know. I don't think it's known how fast that happens. In some cases, it is known, and it's pretty slow. Individual molecules live a day or two in there, but it's not. But as far as I know, for central synapses, it's not actually known what the lifetime of an individual component is. Yeah, Barry.
You guys did these measurements. Did you ever look at two synapses that were adjacent that are in the same axon?
Yes.
Correlations?
Yes, there is. There's an enormous variability, as you can see. This is not a random sample, but this is characteristic of this distribution here actually underestimates the small fellows, because they were just sort of less interesting. Most of the synapses are very small. Hey, David. Most of the synapses are very small, and this underestimates it. There's a very wide variability. We have measured this distribution of sizes of all of a big sample of synapses that one cell makes onto another cell, and they have this wide distribution. And all of the synapses that receive from a bunch of different cells have the same wide distribution. So it's characteristic. So if you have one cell, its axon goes out and makes us a bunch of synapses. If you look across those synapses, they're extremely widely distributed, like this. However, if you look at adjacent synapses, they're correlated from the same presynaptic axon. So big tends to be next to big, small tends to be next to small. And it stretches, the correlation stretches over maybe 30 or 50 microns. It's not known. Not by me anyway.
Two adjacent presynaptic terminal types are going to be a kind of two adjacent
spines. That's why it's a different question.
Yeah, right. And I don't think there's any correlation, but I can't think of anybody who's looked at it. Okay, so what we've done now is I've shown you a bunch of structures, and I've hinted at the fact that the way this works is that these vesicles, under control of calcium, fuse with the membrane and let the glutamate go out. That means that when a nerve impulse comes, the only vesicles that are available immediately to be released are some subset of these vesicles here. And what I'm going to tell you now is that there is a physiological correlate of this docked vesicle pool here, which is what's called the readily releasable pool. And that is that if you stimulate a synapse very quickly in a way that makes it dump all of its vesicles very quickly before it has a chance to dock any new ones there, you can count the number of vesicles that got dumped. And if you do that, it turns out that it's close to the same number as are here. And I'll show you some data for that. Okay, so the way you do this experiment is, well, first of all, let me just give you an example. That's useless anyway. What we do is we go back and forth between working on synapses in slices of the brain that are taken out and working in synapses in culture. What I didn't tell you is that in 1 microliter of cortex, there are 10 to the ninth synapses, 10 to the 5th neurons, and 4 kilometers of axons in every microliter of cortex. So they're really packed in there. And it's very hard to study individual ones. You can't study them. However, you can study synapses in culture. So what you do is you get a mouse or a rat. He gives you his brain. You shred it up. You put it in a petri dish. Let it grow, and this is a neuron that from a rat brain, and these are dendrites, and then we've used a stain, which I'll tell you maybe a little bit later, called FM143, which stains the synapses that are active, and so here you can see a bunch of synapses that on this cell that were active, and so you can study one individual synapse. You can look at it, and you can actually study these same synapses. There are tricks for studying these individual synapses electrophysiologically. So this thing you can barely see here is a recording electrode that's recording the electrical activity from this cell. And in this particular experiment, we didn't do it, but with other experiments we have. What you do is you do microperfusion. So you pick a synapse here that's kind of far away, and you know the cell it's coming from, and you flow a solution right across here. So the whole rest of the cell is bathed in a solution that blocks synaptic transmission. And then you permit synaptic transmission only to occur in one location here. So you can study electrophysiologically one synapse that way. Okay, so then you say, well, how do you know these synapses are the same as the ones in brain? Maybe you put them in culture, they're totally different. So what you always have to do is you always have to go back and forth between slices and culture and check everything between. And there's some differences between cultures and slices, but basically they're the same. Okay, so what you do then is, one way of doing this is you record from a cell in culture like this, and you flow hypertonic solution, solution that has sucrose in it, over a bunch of synapses, and you've counted the number underneath it. So what hypertonic solution does is that that there are all these vesicles that are lined up waiting to be released, and they have to be released. And once calcium comes in here, this vesicle has to be released in less than 100 microseconds. It's a very rapid event. It's a very high energy event to have this membrane fuse with that membrane. If you just put vesicles and membranes together, they fuse at an extremely low rate because they have to get close together and they have to disrupt the structure and incorporate one into the other. And so there's special proteins that are inside here, sticking up inside there, that are lowering the energy barrier for vesicle fusion, so that you can just change the conformation of a protein, the synaptotagmin fellow, and have this vesicle fuse like that. What that means, though, is that the energy barrier is low enough that once in a while, just by chance, one of these vesicles will fuse, and at a single site, a vesicle fuses like once a minute by chance. And then when its conformational change occurs, it fuses inside 100 microseconds. You can lower that energy barrier for fusion in a number of different ways. One way you can do it is you can just change the pressure inside the cell here. Just literally hook an electrode to the inside of the cell and put a hydrostatic pressure there, and that changes the release probability. That changes the fusion of these vesicles. Another thing you can do is you can change the characteristics of the lipid membrane. Another thing you can do is you can put a solution that has a high concentration of an impermeant species like sucrose in it. If you flow that over, what happens is that all of the cells, the water flows out of the cell due to the osmotic pressure of the extracellular stuff. The cell shrinks down. That lowers the energy barrier for fusion here, and you get a bunch of fusion events. And there are other ways of doing this, but there's certain advantages for doing it this way with hypertonic solution that I just told you. The advantages are that the other way of doing it is just to stimulate over here. You can get the same answers by doing that, but the trouble is that it's just hard. The experiments are harder to design because when you stimulate, calcium comes in. The calcium that makes these vesicles fuse also does a whole lot of other stuff inside there, and it's hard to separate out the other events from the calcium. They obscure what you're trying to see from just the pure release. And it turns out that this just using this mechanical way of lowering the energy barrier for fusion doesn't involve calcium at all. There's no calcium that comes in that releases without that. So it's just a technically easy way of doing it. Yes?
Yeah, you mentioned the differences between cultures and slices.
Yeah.
So why do you study cultures at all? I mean, is there some experiments that you do in cultures that you can't do?
Oh, yeah. We can study this one synapse there, and then we can go back and do electron microscopy on it. It's very hard to do in slices. It's hard to study one synapse, hard to control its environment, hard to know which synapse you were studying. You can do it, but not as directly. So what we do is we will pick a synapse and study that synapse physiologically, and then go back and find the same synapse in an electron microscope and reconstruct it in three dimensions. And that's something you can't do in practice. And for us, we do it routinely. I mean, it's a hard lot of work, but we do it routinely. So there are a lot of things you can do where you can study populations of synapses, where you can study it in culture. There are things you can do, just technical things that you just can't do in the brain. One of the things you can do is you can know the source of every, you can stimulate every single synapse on this cell and know the source of every single one of them in culture. And you can't stimulate every synapse on a cell in the brain because you can't get at all the presynaptic one. There are about 10,000 on the, or 20,000 on the synapse. Yeah. Okay, so here's the experiment. So what you do is you take the cell in culture, you flow the hypertonic solution over it, which has been known for 50 years to cause release of neurotransmitter, and it's been studied a lot over this time. And when you do that, the rate of vesicle fusion, when you put the hypertonic solution on and the cell shrinks down, and the rate of vesicle fusion jumps way up. It comes down exponentially like this. And then you turn to a steady state value, you turn the hypertonic solution off, and it and the vesicles stop being released. You can count, you can see that every time one vesicle fuses, there's a rapid event in the postsynaptic cell, and you can detect each one of those. And so if you know the number of synapses, And you can measure the current flow from each synapse, and you can count the number of vesicles that were released, and by doing that you can count the number of vesicles per synapse. And basically what you do is you just count how many are released to get down here to this steady state. You have to correct a little bit for the ones that are kind of docking during the period you do it. And then after you do this, What you're doing is you're depleting all the vesicles that are available to be released, and then after a while they come back, they redock again, and this is the time course of recovery of the redocking. And in this particular case, it was like 5 or 10 seconds. Yes.
When you say synapse, you mean all the active zones in a given photon, or
the hippocampal synapses have. In culture, about 20% have two active zones. In brain, it's maybe 5% have more than one active zone. And if they do have two active zones, they're never onto the same postsynaptic cell, or virtually never. There's one example. So what you're doing is you're studying one bouton, one active zone, the number of dock vesicles. Yeah. There are synapses that have many active zones, big synapses. Inhibitory synapses tend to have multiple active zones because they tend to be bigger. And some excitatory synapses have lots of active zones, like the ones that the ganglion cells in the retina make in the LGN have many active zones. But most synapses in the central nervous system have just one active zone, the of excitatory ones. Okay, so with this technique, you can count the number of vesicles that are released, and then using two different techniques, you can compare the number of vesicles that are immediately available for release with the number of vesicles that are docked. And the way you do that is you use a dye called FM143, and that dye has a hydrophilic tail, a hydrophobic tail, and a hydrophilic head, and it has a conjugated double bond system in its head that fluoresces when you excite it, fluoresces green, but only when its head is in the environment right next to the membrane. So if you put this dye just in solution and shine a light on it, a UV light on it, doesn't fluoresce. But when it goes into the membrane, it fluoresces, and it comes out with a time constant of about 2 seconds, 2.5 seconds. So what you do is you put dye on the outside, you stimulate in the way that causes the release of one readily releasable pool from all of the synapses. And usually we do this with electrical stimulation, not with hypertonic solution, because we do this, it's more convenient to do it that. There are other reasons. And then every time a vesicle opens to the outside, dye comes in, and then the vesicles get taken back in, refilled, and reused. So the process by which the vesicle opens up and lets the transmitter out is called exocytosis. And then following that, there are several modes of endocytosis, where the vesicle is taken back in, recycled back up there. So what you can do is, if you stimulate in the presence of FM143, you can stain a whole bunch of these vesicles so they fluoresce. And then you wash the FM143 on the outside out, and your Bouton fluoresces. And actually, the picture that I showed you before that had the green synapses, that was FM143 there. You can detect the fluorescence change from one vesicle. And that means that by looking at how brightly each synapse fluoresces, you can tell how many vesicles had been released and taken back up. And for every vesicle released, one has to be taken up, or else the membrane would change, and the thing would either grow or shrink over time. So, and actually, there are alternative ways of doing the experiment where you don't have to worry about the fact that for every vesicle taken up, one is released. So then you can, with FM143, for a whole bunch of synapses, you can count the individual, you can count the number of vesicles that were released at each synapse, and then you can go back in the electron microscope, find those same synapses, serial section through them, reconstruct them, and count the number of docked vesicles. And when you do that, you get a graph like this, where this is the number of vesicles that were released when you released all the immediately available vesicles, and this is the number of vesicles that were docked, so they're the same. Okay, so there's another way of doing it, which is to stain all the vesicles that you release with this immediately releasable pool, to stain them with FM, and then do a trick that makes a precipitate in all the vesicles that have the fluorescent dye, and then just count in individual synapses, count all the ones that were docked and all the ones that were stained. And when you do that, you get a graph like this, where this is the number of docked vesicles, this is the number of stained vesicles, and it's a pretty good relation. These are error-prone methods. Okay, now. What I've been talking about so far is just kind of the mechanics of how these things happen. But it turns out that there are some far-reaching functional correlates of what I've been talking about. So you'll notice that this is... Okay, let me take a step back. When a nerve impulse comes to a typical synapse in the hippocampus, on average, 2 or 3 times out of 10, a vesicle fusion event happens, and 7 or 8 times out of 10, no signal is transmitted from cell 1 to cell 2. This happens, so synapses are, in the same sense as a coin, are very unreliable. They only release they only release their neurotransmitter with a probability of about 0.2 or 0.3, although different synapses have different release probabilities. Why would you? Yes. Yes, and in fact, it's debated whether it changes with LTP. People say it does, people say it doesn't. But there's no question that it is something that does change enormously. And in fact, the thing that I showed you at the very beginning is all due to changes in release probability. And basically what I'm going to be telling you in the next few minutes is that big synapses have high release probabilities that have a lot of Dock vesicles, and basically the relationship between the number of Dock vesicles and the release probability is known, and that as you use the synapse, you deplete the vesicles, and so the release probability goes down. And there are other things that make it go up, and this combination of things is what gives the, gives rise to the filtering effects. Yeah.
How many boosters between two cells? How many boosters between two cells for synaptic and presynaptic? You are talking about one neuron.
Yes.
But if I have two cells, how many connections can
there
be between
these? In the hippocampus, between the cell that feeds, I'm recording from a cell over here, there's a cell over here that feeds it, one.
So it's like one to one?
One to one. Usually, it's and in general, there are exceptions to this, but in general, the number of synapses that one cell makes onto another cell in the central nervous system is zero or one. So there are few. In the cortex, that's what's true. Yeah, there are cases where you can find, say, six, but that's exceptional. The majority of the synapses on a cell are only coming from one other cell. There are a few cases where there are maybe a half a dozen synapses on a cell out of the 10 or 20,000 that came from one cell. There are a small population of those, but mostly it's just one.
So it is like in the cortex, if you say that the probability of release is 0.2.
Yes.
But if you have five synapses between two cells, then the transmission is high.
Point 0.2 to the fifth power or something, yeah. Minus one. One minus that to the fifth power. Minus one. Yeah. So, but in the central nervous system, if you, most of the connections are quite unreliable. There are some exceptions, but they're mostly quite. Okay. So, the let me just take a sidestep here and talk about why you would want to do it this way. I mean, why would you want to make a brain which has to be reliable out of unreliable components, things that behave so probabilistically? And there are, I don't know the answer, but I'll give you a couple of reasons that I think are true. So one of the main differences in architecture between our brains and a computer, there are many differences. One is that we don't have a separate memory. We don't have a memory over there and a processor over here, and we go from the processor to get stuff. Our memories are embedded in the circuits that do the computation. So that's a different kind of architecture. Another thing is that every organism, evolution has designed to be as reliable and as resilient as possible, but between the mammals, or the vertebrates in general, and the invertebrates, there are two big differences in strategy. The strategy that invertebrates use is they make many, 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 many copies of each organism, and they hope a few of them get their genes through for the next time. Whereas vertebrates, and especially mammals, only make a few copies, but they make each copy be extremely fault tolerant, so it has a good chance of getting through. So, for example, in a neuron that moves a leg of a cockroach or something like that, there'll be one nerve cell that is responsible for moving one particular part of the movement, whereas in us there will be 1,000 nerve cells that are responsible for the same part of the movement. So we get fault tolerance. We have fault tolerant brains. Every brain is designed to be as fault tolerant as possible. But you wipe out one nerve cell in the brain of a cockroach, and you will wipe out a particular function. You wipe out one nerve cell in us, it makes no difference because we're fault tolerant. We do it by redundancy. So if you have a connections here that are going over to there, then usually instead of having one cell here doing something over there, you'll have 300 cells over here doing the same thing to 300 cells over there. And that means if you take any one away, it's less than 1% change, and so you can tolerate it. And you can take away, if you do it the right way, you can take away more than half of the neurons in a brain and still get quite high functioning. So there are kids with epilepsy from birth where the way they treat it is they just take away half of the brain. And these kids are not geniuses, but they function quite well afterwards, much better than you'd think. And if you take cells away at random, you can take away maybe a third of our neurons. So I would guess that President Reagan, when he was still president, had maybe only three quarters of his neurons. And he functioned at quite a high level. Given that you take a quarter of the neurons out of my computer, it's not going to do as well as Reagan did. So yes. Yes, right. Okay, so I'm getting to that. So you've got to have redundancy. That means that you have a cell here. You have to pack in, say, 300 more synapses in a small space. In order to do that, yes.
Relevant to the previous statement.
Yes.
Regarding the philosophy of the system, Bill Bialik, who was here, his main motive was efficiency.
Efficiency, yes. Bill is big on efficiency, right.
So, however, he definitely studies invertebrates. So would you say that the system of invertebrates is maybe designed for efficiency?
I think that evolution has pushed us all to optimize something, and depending on how you define efficiency, then that's going to be optimized, and it's going to be optimized in us, but we may use slightly different strategies for optimizing it, and this is what I'm saying. So we have an additional constraint, which is we want to have fault tolerance through redundancy. So if you're going to have a whole bunch of synapses packed into a small space, all hooking onto a cell, you have a wiring problem. How are you going to hook all these things together? Well, you've got to make the synapses small. If you make a synapse small, you can't make it reliable. Because if it's reliable, then every time a nerve impulse came, you release a vesicle, and there are only a small number of vesicles in there. You run out. It takes a while to dock them back up again. And so what you do is you get redundancy. You make all the synapses be very small, but it doesn't matter that they're probabilistic because you're averaging over a bunch of them anyway. And that's exactly what you want. You want each one to contribute very little, so you average over them. In addition, it's really advantageous to have the release probability be low. And the reason is that since you're averaging anyway, you can change release probability by an order of magnitude at a lot of synapses. You can go from 0.05 up to 0.5 with no trouble at all. This happens all the time. And in fact, you can do it extremely quickly by mechanisms we're going to talk about. And so what that means is that you can change synaptic strength very rapidly by changing release probability. And that is the major way that synaptic strength is changed rapidly. And since you have to go across a bunch of synapses anyway, since you have to average across a bunch anyway, then there's no disadvantage. Yeah. Okay, so... This is for short-term potentiation, and we'd have to talk about long-term potentiation. That's a more complicated issue. Yeah.
Just on your point of redundancy. So, is there evidence, and maybe you could give us some culture, where as you start to drop out the number of neurons, right, and therefore drop out the number of synaptic contacts, that the reliability, maybe the size of the endpoint goes up. I mean, and maybe in a culture system, you could look at one synapse affecting another cell and look at the reliability of the synapse and then wait until the cell actually has very many contacts on the second cell. Is there something like the number of reliability varies with the number of contacts in some way that suggests a compensation?
Well, the synapses in culture have the same regulatory mechanisms that the same ones do in the brain. Those are kind of built in.
Yeah.
And so they don't, in general, get much bigger or more reliable than synapses in the brain do, comparable. In other words, the release probability in culture and then in the brain is not different.
So you're saying that reliability is then that you're not just training numbers against failure rates, that you're you have to have a very large gap until the failure rate actually hurts you. And that's expressing this clearly. I mean, you're in some sort of saturation level already for the probability of missing an interaction.
Well, I mean, a way of thinking about it is that the size of your signal is going to be proportional to n, the number of synapses, and the uncertainty is going to be like the square root of n. And so the bigger n is, the less it is, and the coefficient of variation, you have someone you can tolerate, and you just make sure you're far away from that.
And there's no compensation, you're saying. If you start to drop down n, you don't.
Well, there is some compensation, because in the brain, there are situations where the synapses change their size in a homeostatic way. But over a pretty small range. Factor of 2 would be a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. So, how would you measure release probability? And there are several individual synapses, and there are several ways of doing it. And one of the ways is to do it in culture, and the other way is to do it in slices. And I'll talk about culture. And then, do you think we ought to take a break, David? Yeah. Okay. This is the last thing I'll say, and then we'll go back. So then, in culture, what you do is you use this FM143 die. You stimulate, say, 30 times. You then wash off the dye, take a picture, and then you stimulate again and you release all the dye there, so you're sure you don't have nonspecific staining. And then you subtract one image from the other, and then you count the number of vesicles that are released, divide by the number of times you stimulated. That's the average. There's something I haven't told you. In this case, it doesn't matter. But this is the fluorescence of a bunch of boutons, and this is the number of boutons that had that fluorescence. And up here, it's been divided by fluorescence, by fluorescence per vesicle. And here's the release probability. And you can see that the peak is right a little bit less than 0.2. The average is about 0.3, which is typical. And there's this wide distribution like that.
Yeah.
This is the release probability at an individual bouton.
For having at least one vesicle.
Yes. It turns out that there's a mechanism that keeps more than one vesicle from being released.
So you cannot have 2, 3, 4?
If you have a single active zone, in general, you can't have more than one released. If your probability, you know, you might by chance have 2 released, doesn't happen. There's a mechanism that turns off, and that has some interesting implications, which I'll tell you later on. So, but these probabilities are in most cases so low that the chances of having 2 releases wouldn't be very big anyway. So, what you're saying, even if there were 2 possible, in most cases you wouldn't notice it for here, because the release bulk of these things are down here with release probabilities less than 0.5, so, you know, at most a quarter of them.
So you know the active zone from maybe like 10 vesicles, you say the release probability for at least one vesicle is this number, and it doesn't depend on the size of the active zone?
No, the release probability depends on the size of the active zone, absolutely.
But it's only one vesicle.
But it depends on it in a way that takes into account the fact that there's only one vesicle can be released per. After a stimulus, there's a dead time of about 5 milliseconds, and during that 5 milliseconds, the energy barrier for another fusion goes way high, and it comes back down to normal again with a. Now we've actually measured that, and I'm going to show you that after a while. And there's a very tight relationship between the number of docked vesicles and the release. I'll just show it to you right now. Then let's take a break. This is the relationship between number of docked vesicles and release probability. So big synapses are strong synapses. Have high release probabilities. Okay, let's take a break. Okay. So in a given sample of say 100 events, there will be smallest ones below which you never see any others, and those are above the resolution of the noise. And so which what if you look at this, it really looks like this. And so you're pretty sure you're not missing anything over here. We actually went to trouble to make sure we weren't missing things.
So you basically said if you go all the way down to the resolution, all the way down to the noise.
Yeah.
And it's compatible with the smaller down the resolution.
Yes. Yeah.
So I mean, that curve on the left, you say, is of fundamental importance because that's setting the noise level itself. Is it
after
transmission?
Yes.
And that itself reflects something else, like noise in the kinetics of clathrin or some molecule. I mean, something that's...
Probably with vesicles different diameters?
Yeah.
Probably. I don't know.
But this is fundamental to the noise discussion. This graph.
This?
Yeah. Everything else you say will flow up from this.
It could. You can't do the experiments the right way to be absolutely sure. All you can do is say, if I take this distribution, I measure the diameters and the variance in them, I predict the shape of this distribution, and I predict the relation, and I predict the coefficient of variation, then you get it right.
Nice.
Yeah. So, yes. Oh, sorry.
Good. The outer diameter, the full diameter, not shaving vesicles partially.
Yeah. Okay, so here is a section of an EM looking from the side, and this is about 60 nanometers. And here is a vesicle on the inside, and it's about 35 nanometers. It's about maybe half as big. And then when you look down through here, what you see is this is density, and this is the, so you take a you're looking down this way. Wait a second, and you take a photograph of it, and then you scan the photograph, and you see this is density in the scan versus distance, and you normally see this. And that would be your diameter if it were all contained inside the section. However, you often see, not often, but you sometimes see this. Where you don't see these peaks. So if you have a vesicle here and you're looking down through it, then you're going to get this. Because you're looking at the back membrane, the density of the back membrane here, and the two side membranes tangentially there. Whereas if you section this like this, it's cut in halfway in the section, then what you're going to see is not much translucent stuff there. You're just going to see mostly opaque, and it's a gray smear. So we do serial sections, and so you can find every vesicle, and you can find out if it's inside your section or if it's appearing also in the neighboring section. And when you see this, when you look in the neighboring section, then you see a corresponding smear. And anytime you see something that is nice and sharp like this, looks it's not just a smear, then it's always within the section. We verified that by doing serial sections. So basically, we only counted vesicles that were within. We're entirely within our section. So, you get a variability in the size. So this is the you get variability in the size of these responses, but the shape is always the same. Okay, now before I asserted that you only get one vesicle released per stimulus, never two. How would you know that? Okay, what you do is you you stimulate you stimulate in a way that changes the probability of release. And the way you do that is the following. If you stimulate once and look at the probability of release, so this is stimulus versus time, and then you stimulate a second time at different times away, then what you find is that the probability of release for the second stimulus is, and then suppose that you sort out all the trials where you saw no release on the first stimulus. Then you do your second stimulus. What you find is you stimulate here, and 7 out of 10 trials are failures. 1 out of 10 is a 3 out of 10 is a release. So the release probability is 0.3. Then what you do is you just throw away all the trials where you had a release on the first, and you only look at the ones where there's a release on the second, and you see what's the probability. And if you look at the probability on the second stimulus as a function of time, and here is 0.3, that's what the probability is on the first stimulus. Then on the second stimulus, the release probability goes up to a high value, and it comes down. Then it comes down actually with 2 time constants, and one of them is about 50 milliseconds, and the other one is about 250 milliseconds. So you can do this experiment different ways. You don't have to do it with a single stimulus, but this is a way of changing the release probability. The synapse remembers having been used and increases its release probability. And this is called facilitation, or it's also often called PPF, for paired pulse facilitation, because you use a pair of pulses and you look at the facilitation on the second as a function of the first. You don't have to do this with a single synapse. You can do it with a whole population of synapses, and you see the same things. This has been known for 50 years, more. Okay, so what this means, though, is that the probability of release is 0.3 here, but you can get the probability of release up to close to one on the second stimulus. So by changing this time here, you can change your release probability over quite a broad range. And then what you do is you separate all of the stimuli into trials where you have a release or no release. And then you average all of the trials together where there has been a release, and you make a graph of the size of response as a function of the release probability. So you measure the release probability at each point along here. You throw away all the trials where there was no release. You average together all the trials where there was a release. And so this is the average size of your response, because the response varies by itself. This is the average size of the response given that you had a response. And if you plot that across here, what you find is that the points vary along where this is a release probability of 0 and here's a release probability of 1. They stay constant. There are other experiments which we could talk about from my laboratory and other laboratories that have shown that you don't saturate the postsynaptic membrane with glutamate, that the response is roughly linear in the region you're talking about. And so what this says is that the size of the response, if you get one on average, doesn't change. If you were releasing 2 vesicles, then the size of the response should go up like this. If you're releasing multiple vesicles, it should go up like that. And so this is one piece of evidence, one of a number of pieces of evidence, all quite different directions, that says you can't release more than one vesicle. And you can measure out the time course of this effect and show that it takes like 10 milliseconds or something. Yeah, dude.
Just to go back to that picture early on, the reconstruction of the endpoint. He said that picture was representative except for the fact that there's actually many more
small synapses.
Small guys.
Yeah.
I mean, so you're not biased somehow by you've got such a preponderance of small guys that this curve is biased.
yeah, it might be. So you might, I don't think it is, because one of the ways that we measured release probability is by just recording from a bunch of cells and making a histogram. And then how many synapses have what release probability? We just recorded from a bunch of cells and made a distribution of release probabilities, and it's not different from that thing I showed you before where we were looking at all the synapses. So I don't think there's a strong bias, but I couldn't be sure that there's not some subset of synapses that don't have this property. And for example, if you have two active zones, then if you were releasing double things quite often, then we would throw those out because we can't tell those from one synapse. So in a way, what we've done is we've said all the things that meet our criteria for a single synapse, which means the response is always the same shape and always the same size and doesn't change with stimulus intensity and things like that, then we may be selecting out a population that are special. Can't be sure. I'm using the facilitation just as a way of changing the release probability. I don't know that it's true for all synapses, but there's a reason that I believe it's true in general. And I'm going to tell you that in a second.
But what's the population of synapses was tested the way you just described?
The particular population that we tested in this way was only hippocampal synapses. But there's a reason why I believe it's true for all synapses, and I'm going to tell you in a second. It would be true for any cortical synapse.
I remember seeing a paper by Alex Thompson.
Yeah.
Showed attention in the RAS synapses to progress even if there was a failure for the first part.
Oh, that's true. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You can get. You would see that there are synapses that depress, and these experiments were done in a way so we avoided that. We could have made these synapses depressed too. I can tell you how in a minute. Yes, looks the same. If you have a release on the first one, in general, it looks the same. In certain cases, it looks exactly the same. In other cases, it doesn't look exactly the same, and there's a complicated reason for that, having to do with how much, with fluctuations in how much calcium comes in, because that's a stochastic process, too. No. The very synapse that I looked at here, I could have made had. We changed the calcium level so we have facilitation, right?
But maybe only under that condition you have one physical link. But if you go to other conditions, maybe you always more.
Well, I can tell you certain conditions where you always get more vesicles released. That's if you have a synapse that has multiple active zones.
No, but I mean.
Yeah. Let me give you the reasons why I think that this is true more generally, that has to do with the properties of facilitation. Okay? And then we'll see. But maybe not. Maybe there are other conditions where you get. So basically what you're doing is that for a period of time right here, you're raising the energy barrier for another fusion. Probably the reason is that the first fusion has deformed the active zone membrane, and so just mechanically, just like changing, you can change the probability of events happening by changing the character of the membrane, by dissolving detergents in there, things like that. And so maybe when you make a vesicle fuse, maybe it kind of squeezes the membrane and raises the energy barrier for neighbors. something like that. That might be why it happens. And so you can imagine situations where if you made the release probability very, very high, then you might have double fusions. It's not that it couldn't possibly happen, it's just that it has a low probability.
Trying to think of an experiment. If I have something which measures like 100 times between lipid sites,
measuring what?
I have a molecule which I can just measure the hopping time between lipid sites, which is an old Terry Eisinger experiment.
Uh-huh.
And you would suggest that right as release takes place, then I should do something like increase the surface tension of the lipid.
Yes. It's hard to measure, but I would agree. You would. You can change kinetics and properties of exocytosis by changing the mechanical properties of the membranes.
But in both directions.
In both directions. Yeah, it's a little complicated because it's a little bit more complicated than you might think, but you can do it. Yeah. Okay. So let's look at this experiment over here. What I'm doing is I stimulate, I measure a bunch of response sizes, and I make a graph of the size of the response as a function of the probability of release, and I find they're all the same size, whereas if the probability of release were this big, you could calculate how many double releases you'd expect to have if there were more than one vesicle there, and you would expect to see more, but you don't. So you use this to conclude that you can only have one release per time. There's also some temporal things too, because you can measure the what happens is that the probability drops to a very low level, and then it stays low for a while, and then it comes back up to its normal high level. So the probability of release as a function of time actually does this. If you have a release, and it does that if you don't have a release, and you can measure that. So now, could this result have occurred if I thought that there was only one synapse there, but it was actually two? I can't see a way. In other words, if there really were two, this experiment would not have worked if there had been two synapses there. Because if you have two synapses there, you change the release probability, they're both going to release, and so you're going to get the size of the response getting bigger. So the experiment would not have given this result if there were two synapses there, but there's no artifact, at least that I can think of, that would make the size of the response invariant to the release probability if you think there's one synapse there, but there are actually two. So this is a result you can believe from this kind of experiment. If I had actually observed this dotted line here, could I then conclude that synapses can release multiply? No, I couldn't, because I couldn't be sure that I hadn't had two synapses there. So the point is, you can only draw conclusions that could not be an artifact of being wrong about how many synapses you have. Yeah. You know, a mechanical propagation would have to, in order to get from one side of the active zone to the other side in 10 microseconds, it'd have to go like this. Because see, it doesn't go very far. These active zones are really small. So if you had biochemistry doing it, that wouldn't work. If you had to change concentrations and things had to diffuse and undergo reactions, that wouldn't work. But mechanical things would work. Okay. So let me go back now and talk about facilitation. Because the thing I started with was I showed you that the synapse, by virtue of its use, is changing its release probability all over the place. And I've told you, although I didn't say it very explicitly, one part of that, and that is if you release a lot in a short period of time, if you have a whole bunch of stimuli that come one after another, and they all are pretty successful in releasing, then you're going to deplete the pool and the release probability is going to drop. That goes according to this. So as you deplete the size of the pool, then then the release probability is going to go down. So that explains why it is you're going to have smaller, how you can go below average when you stimulate a lot. But how do you get above? And how you get above is this phenomenon that I just told you about of facilitation. But facilitation has an interesting property, and this and the property of facilitation is interesting is shown here. This is the release probability on the first pulse of a pair, and this is the amount of facilitation you get, which is the ratio of the release probability on the second pulse to the release probability on the first pulse. This is facilitation. And what you can see is that there's a lot of scatter, but high probability synapses have almost no facilitation, and low probability synapses have a lot of facilitation. Yeah? It's going to make sense in a minute. This is an experimental observation.
Yeah, but the model that you're presenting to us is that large synapses that have lots of vesicles have high probabilities.
And they have little facilitation. That's correct.
How can I facilitate them? If it's already one.
No, but even here's a synapse that's 0.5. It has hardly any facilitation at all. So a synapse that has enough vesicles to be release probability of 0.5. No, 20. If it's 0.5, it could do twofold. It could go up to 1. If it's 0.05, it could go 20-fold.
0.5 is bounded by 9, which comes down.
So here's 0.5.
So the highest value possible
is 1.
No.
This is facilitation. This is.
It cannot be larger than 2.
Facilitation. Well, right here it's 4.5.
Or 0.5.
At 0.5.
So there is curve which bounds
all. Oh yes, right. It can't be higher than 2 here. But it's less than 2. So it's always less than which you'd expect. Okay, so this is
again down to the failures of the first five.
No, this particular thing is done, but this is not failures on the first flight. This is just stimulate and see release probability. Yeah, this is just release probability. Okay, you can change this curve. How can you change it? Actually, if you take a synapse that is right here and has a release probability of 0.8 and no facilitation, or say here 0.5 and essentially no facilitation. If you take this synapse here, you can give it a lot of facilitation. And the way you do that is you change the release probability so it's down here and it immediately will facilitate. And you do that by changing calcium and magnesium and things like that. So you can take any synapse and you can move it along this curve and it will change its release probability. But there's another way. But what I said before was that release probability under a given set of circumstances reflects the size of the pool of vesicles that are doing the releasing. And you can also change facilitation by simply depleting a synapse. So if you take a synapse and you deplete it, you take a synapse that's sitting over here and is not facilitating, if you then deplete that synapse so the readily releasable pool is depleted, then you'll get facilitation. So facilitation depends on how much calcium is sitting around from before, but it also depends on how many vesicles are trying to be released. And I'll show you why that happens. Yeah. Okay.
So suppose we go back to the guys that only have one vessel.
Okay.
Then if you have probability of release 1 on the first pulse.
No, you wouldn't. A single vesicle has a release probability of like 0.05.
So that's the point. Things are tied. Because in principle, this thing could have gone below 1.
Yeah. No, the release probabilities, a single vesicle has a release probability of 0.05, never as much as 0.1. 0.02, things like that. So and there's almost nothing you can do to make a single vesicle have a, at least as far as I know, have a really high release probability, like one.
So maybe this is not relevant, but if I think of the synapse, like the photoreceptors, there's many vessels, but they're kind of lined up in a row.
That's a ribbon synapse, right? They're different.
Okay, so I don't get the idea of just this one vessel sitting in front of a tiny active zone, and it goes, and another guy takes its place.
Now, those synapses, those are ribbon synapses. Those are special, and they're different in many ways. I don't know exactly how they relate to these, but they even have different proteins. For example, they don't even have some of the same proteins. Like every synapse in the brain has synapsin. That's a protein that's used for labeling. They don't have synapsin in those ribbon synapses. So it's just different. Okay, so where does this come from? Why is it that how can facilitation is believed to be something where there's just it's remembering, there's evidence for this, it's remembering how much calcium is there. But how is it that this vesicle right here knows how many other vesicles are around it, so it can change its facilitation according to that. And here's the only explanation I can think of. The probability on the first trial of a stimulus, of a release, is equal to 1 minus 1 minus alpha to the n. Alpha is the probability that a single vesicle would release. 1 minus alpha is the probability that a single vesicle wouldn't release. N is the number of vesicles that are there. When you stimulate, all N have a chance, all N try to release. And then the probability that none of them release is 1 minus, is 1 minus, the probability that everyone fails to the nth power. The probability that at least one releases is 1 minus that. So this is the probability. This is the relationship between probability and pool size. And that relationship is drawn on this curve over here. Except it's not quite drawn. This is a slightly fancier version. But the relationship I just told you would go like this. It would miss these points down here. It wouldn't have an inflection. So there's something else going on that I haven't told you down here. But from here, from a pool size of like 3 up, then the theory I just said that's this where this value, where n is the number over there and alpha is 0.05 or something. Okay, now we have a second synapse. The probability of release the second time is 1 minus 1 minus phi times alpha to the n. Alpha is the same release probability for a single vesicle as before. Phi is how much that release probability has been changed by virtue of remembering that calcium is there. And so phi, as a function of time after a stimulus, jumps up and it comes down over time and it finally gets back to a value of 1. And it goes up to 5 or something like that. So this is facilitation. And each vesicle has a higher probability. And then the facilitation that you measure is equal to P2 divided by P1.
So P2 is either n or n minus 1, depending on whether it fired at all the first time?
No, yes, right, either n or n minus 1, right. And n's are big enough, and the n's that I'm talking about are all big enough that I'm going to neglect that it might have been n minus 1. In other words, I'm going to talk about synapses that are kind of have release probabilities over 0.2 and above or something like that, just to make it simpler. Okay, now there are two ways of doing what I'm going to do. There's a right way and an approximate way, and you don't have to make any approximations, but the algebra is easier if you do. And that is, if you alpha is a very small number, so this is really close to 1 minus e to the minus alpha n. because if you expand this to first order, you're going to get that. And it's really close. You don't have to do this. You can do it directly. There's more algebra. And this is very close to 1 minus e to the minus alpha times n times phi. And so that means that the ratio of these two things is going to be 1 minus e to the minus alpha n times phi divided by 1 minus e to the minus alpha n, which is equal to p1 times 1 minus 1 minus p1 to the phi power. So what I did is I took that p1 is this. I solved for e to the minus alpha n. I noticed that e to the minus alpha n raised to the phi power is what's here. So this is e to the minus alpha n raised to the phi power. So this is the same as that. Did I do something wrong? Something's wrong. Is it right? Yeah, phi is. What's bothering me is if p. Okay, I guess it's right. Okay, so if you plot this curve out, so you measure p1 and you have one parameter here, which is how much facilitation you have, and so if you plot this curve out, then you get. You get one of the ones, you get this solid line here. So it fits pretty well. So the reason why facilitation increases when you decrease the size, when you deplete the synapse, so there are no vesicles there, is because you're changing this n here. If you make n smaller, then that makes p smaller in such a way that it makes the facilitation be bigger. So the reason I believe then, because it's a universal property of facilitation at synapses, that when you change the release probability, you change the amount of facilitation, and this explains why that happens. So this is why I believe that, and this, what I just wrote down here is dependent on the fact that you're restricting the release to just one vesicle, because the way that this vesicle here knows how many other vesicles are around is it senses if they have been successful in releasing and they don't release. So that's the mechanism of this vesicle knowing how many other ones are around there. It gets shut off, and the probability it gets shut off depends on how many other ones that are there. Okay. So anyway, the reason then that I believe that is probably more general, that synapses have this property of exclusion to one vesicle, aside from the fact that people have reported different synapses, is that as far as I know, this kind of curve here is a universal property of synapses. You can see it in lots of synapses. If you change release probability, you get more facilitation. And you can change release probability in different ways, either by depleting the synapse or by changing calcium or something, and you get it. Yeah?
But I don't understand where you use this fact that only one vesicle
is released. Let me appear. One, the see if you had if you could have two releases, then what you have to do is I'm calculating the probability that at least one vesicle is being released.
Yeah. So the problem, I mean, even if you had a model where they're completely independent, you could still get the probabilities of release of something being released. So if, you
know,
don't see where.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, because the probability that you get, this is the probability that you get at least one release, which is not the same as the probability that you would get a release, because you might have two or three. Right? Am I?
If you do the experiment, you just count how many times you failed.
Yeah.
And not failed.
Yeah.
P1 would be a probability not to fail.
P1 would be the probability not to fail, yes. Yeah, but if you here's a vesicle here. This vesicle knows how many other vesicles are around. How does it know that? It could be that they signal in some way. It has some way of counting them. But what I claim, the way that it knows it is that if this vesicle over there releases, it tells this one not to. And the chances that one over there will release depends on how many of them there are. So the communication to this vesicle here that decides whether it's going to release or not depends on the another number that are around, and that's what determines the facilitation.
That's what determines the five. Facilitation is only this part number five.
But facilitation is only number five, right?
In other words, to say this formula that you use for P1, and when you wrote it down, you said at least one.
But yes.
If you really represent correctly the case of P, etc., which I in principle included in at least one.
Yes.
Because it assumes independence.
Yes.
You say there is independence. Therefore, this describes only P1 and P2 with a difference.
Yes. Okay. At any rate, the maybe it's not right. I mean, I know it. Yes, Barry.
So what would you do with the synapses that are paired for the functions that are totally independent and parallel processes?
Okay. So there are at least two mechanisms of paired pulse depression. One mechanism is surely depletion, because if you stimulate a bunch of times, you get these, and you do it in a way that you don't have facilitation. Like you use sucrose, the release probability goes down, and it goes down from the first to the second. That's that graph I showed you with the release rate going down when you put on sucrose. So certainly there is depression. Certainly there is a paired pulse depression of a certain amount that comes from depletion. But I don't think that's the main thing. I think that most synapses have other mechanisms of paired pulse where they remember the calcium influx in a different way, or they turn off their sodium channels or something like that. And so I think that there are multiple mechanisms of depletion, of depression, and depletion is one, and probably at most synapses it's not the major one for a single pair.
And this synapse.
No, it does have depression.
Pulse.
No, in culture, there's a lot of depression in culture. These particular experiments were done in slice. There's not much depression in slice. But this particular synapse in culture is different, especially when it's younger. And it shows a lot of paired pulse depression. And I don't know where the depression comes from. I don't think it's depletion, but I don't know where it does come from. It has a different time course from the recovery from depletion. So it's probably not going to be depletion, unless it's something I don't understand about depletion.
But, so it comes to the general conclusion.
I think it's of all the synapses I know, it's a property that if you change the release probability, you change the amount of facilitation. Okay, let's think about it. That's a puzzle. You have a synapse and it's releasing and it's not and it's not facilitating. If you, it's absolutely established that, as far as I understand, it's absolutely established that the mechanism of facilitation is calcium that hangs around after the stimulus, because you put EGTA or Baptin, you can just totally wipe out facilitation. So it's remembering the calcium, and and yet, how do you make more facilitation? The way you make more facilitation is you have less calcium come in. That doesn't make sense. If facilitation is due to calcium being there, having less calcium come in should not give you more facilitation. It ought to give you, if anything, less facilitation. What? If you have a site that's saturated, then you might have something like this. But the fact is that the lower that you
get to a point, experimentally, no one's really been able to do that because P of release drops off so fast.
But you get gigantic facilitation when you lower the lower you lower the calcium, the more facilitation you get. Always. That's not what you'd expect.
It's always true here, but not always true. I can quote you a chapter and verse on synapses that don't show more.
That don't show facilitation?
No, that don't show more and more and more facilitation.
Really?
As you keep dropping calcium.
Calcium?
One that has an extremely low probability of release at the beginning, crayfish neuromuscular synapses, the classic
example. Which synapses is this?
Crayfish. Crayfish.
Okay. Mammalian synapses.
I'm
sorry, I couldn't help it.
It's a very important thing that I think it's been skipping over. You deftly made alpha small.
Made what?
Alpha. You deftly made it quite small.
I made it small because that's what it is.
But that's...
I didn't...
this discussion that I'm detecting here about, depressing synapses, et cetera. The story would change if alpha per vesicle was very low.
Sure.
Right? Then you'd be looking at something that would actually be predicting it that start to show depression.
Sure. I've never.
I'm trying to resolve the
yeah. None of the synapses that I know have a big alpha, when it's measured, where you look at release probability and you see how many vesicles are there. But it's only been measured for a few synapses, right?
But if you made alpha large, would you not end up with depression? This curve wouldn't exist anymore.
If you made alpha very large, this curve wouldn't be the same. Sorry, but I don't personally know any synapses. But I'm not saying they don't exist. I just don't know any like that. Yeah.
Is the same story apply to inhibitory synapses together?
No, it wouldn't, because inhibitory synapses have multiple active zones. And
but
so.
Active zone.
I don't know. You can't study it because you can't get rid of. You can't study a single active zone in an inhibitory synapse. But if you did the same experiments, you would not get the same answers on inhibitory synapses because they have multiple active zones. So in effect, you have independent things happening. So it wouldn't happen the same way.
You have an upper bound. You would still predict an upper bound.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Right. Yeah. So I don't know about the experiments that have been done, but at least exactly the way this is done, it wouldn't work. Okay, so theory aside, the experimental observations are that as you change the number of vesicles that are, yes. Okay.
It looks to me that you say in most of the synapses alpha is small,
yes.
N is big.
No, N is small too. N is like, on average, N is like 6, 5.
Okay, so this would mean, let's forget about facilitation for a moment, think about depression. Depression can never be stronger than if you go from N
to N minus 1. N-1, right.
But how come you have synapses in the...
This is what I was saying to Barry. This is what I was saying to Barry, that there are multiple mechanisms for depression.
So that's not due to
depletion is one mechanism,
okay.
Which can happen, but it's probably not the biggest mechanism, at least in hippocampus.
I see. So what's the biggest one?
I don't know what it is.
Depressing phi also, right?
Oh yeah, you change phi, but how you change phi, the mechanism is that's what's not. No, you do change phi.
Okay, so you say you it's not enough to have n to n minus 1.
No, not normally. Not normally, no. You have a little bit of depression, and if you have a small synapse, you can have quite a bit, you know, 30% or something.
But not
40%.
Sometimes.
No, but there's definitely, and you know there's a different mechanism, because see, they follow different time courses. The time course for recovery from paired pulse depression follows a different time course from the recovery of refilling. So they, so deep.
They measure separately.
Yeah.
Feeling and they recover from depression.
Yeah.
They don't go.
No. No. So you're sure that there's other mechanisms. It's just that the other mechanisms aren't well known. At least not by me. I mean, there are a bunch of mechanisms that are known, like calcium channel inactivation happens, or depression, or something like that. Things like that happen, but I don't know more. Okay, so we're almost done. It's going to take me 2 minutes now. So whether you believe this or not, this is all beside the point. The experimental fact is that as you change the release probability, that you can change the release probability by depleting the pool of vesicles. You can do that experiment and show the release probability changes. You can deplete the pool in several different ways, and you find it's true. You can look across a bunch of synapses that just happen to have different size pools. The release probability follows that. So we've actually, I didn't show this data, but we've actually measured in the same synapses release probability, pool size, and counted the dark vesicles, and they all correlate the way you'd expect. So what you also know is that the facilitation is changing pool size. So it's a kind of complicated, the reason that this thing I started with, oh, by the way, I'll just say this. These are data that I'm not going to show you. I hate it when people do this in talks. they throw up a transparency, and I'm not going to show you this. But anyway, were I to show you this, what it would show you is that if you look at a single synapse that and put in this natural spike train, you get the same behavior, and the behavior that I showed you in the very first slide, and the behavior is through a change in release probability.
So like you're saying, we take this model literally.
No model. Just if you do experiments and ask, remember the very first thing I showed you with all the scatter, and then if you do the same thing with a single synapse and say, what's changing? Is it the size of the postsynaptic response, or is it release probability that's changing? What changes the release probability?
So I'm trying to understand. You're saying that the variability you showed at the beginning is explained by facilitation?
By a combination of historic effects, among them facilitation and depletion. But you
can't. What else?
Oh, there are many things.
But if we just took these two,
it wouldn't explain it. It would not explain it.
Well, this is not enough even to specify the model, because it tells you how phi changes from one phi to the second, but if you have several, you have also to assume something about how this accumulates.
Sure. Anyway. I was not taking this model as the model we would use. The normal model is the one that Carl McElby started with a long time ago, where you just have a facilitation add a little increment each time. And that model will not work to show you the data I in the beginning. And you can see why it wouldn't work. And the reason is that as you use the synapse a lot, you deplete it. As you deplete it, you change release probability by depletion, but you also change release probability through facilitation because the facilitation couples through the size of the pool left over. So it's going to be a simple model like Carl's can possibly work, but it doesn't work.
But the combination could work.
The combination doesn't work.
It still doesn't.
No. But there are other things that are going on. You know that are so it couldn't work. At any rate, what this shows is that the thing that I showed you in the beginning. This is a natural spike train that was presented to a single synapse. This is release probability as a function of stimulus number. The way you do the experiment is you take a shortened spike train and you play it into the synapse, burp, and then you do it again and again. You go have coffee and you let it sit there, play in. Then you come back and you sort out the data to find parts that are stationary, where nothing is changing over time. And then you line them all up and you go across and count the release probabilities for each stimulus, and you plot them. And this is the fraction of stimuli that gave a response as a function of stimulus number, and you get the same variability that you got before. you also, for these same things, you measure the size of the postsynaptic response as a function of release probability up here. So the release probability is changing a lot. Here you plot the average size of the response if you get one versus release probability, and it stays flat. So this says that that thing I showed you before is a presynaptic phenomenon. It's showing that release probability changes. Okay, so the point I was making, though, is that that I've showed you two things that are going on. One thing is facilitation. One thing is depression. They play into each other in a quite complicated way, because the amount of facilitation changes as you deplete, and also changes with time. In addition to that, there are other phenomena. So there's another phenomenon that if you stimulate for a long period of time, the size of the pool N, the thing I call N here, after a long period of stimulation, this N shrinks to a smaller number, and then with a time course of a minute or two, grows back to the number that it had before. So this thing here changes as a function of history. Yeah, you do reach a steady state if you stimulate for a long time. But it's very variable still. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, let me just, so we can have lunch. So basically, what I'm saying is that there's buried in here an interesting theoretical problem, and that is asking the question, what is it that this synapse is trying to find out by these complicated changes in history?
I guess what I don't see is if you could write down even if there's many underlying events, if it's possible to make a list, right, of all the underlying events, like, you know, facilitation, depletion, and then say, can I, at least for consistency, is the data that's available that allows me to model each of those events, can I take those models and then
account for the whole thing? Right. Okay. And we have made models of individual things, a lot of them, with different time courses, and they're sufficiently complicated with where there's enough adjustability in some of the parameters, because you would not measure every parameter separately for these data, that I believe we could probably fit it. But that would say more about my persistence in trying to fit it than it would about what's true in nature. It would be an existence proof. It would show that you could account for it with those data. But even if I could write down for you every equation and replicate the experiment perfectly that I showed you in the beginning, even if I could do that, there's still an interesting question there, and that is, what is it looking for? What kind of spike train needs to be put in to what's it trying to find when it does this? It's probably doing it for a reason. What's that reason? I don't know. That's not a well-formed question.
It's not well-formed because you haven't posed. I mean, normally when things have an optimal signal coming in some sense, when things have a response, maximizing or minimizing.
Sure.
Do you have?
I don't know. That's what you have to figure out. You have to think about it.
Just from looking at a lot of data, do you have in mind a target?
No. No, I don't. And that's what I said in the beginning, that if I knew what it was looking for, then I could write down equations and I could do it too. I wouldn't have to, you know, if it was a well-posed problem, then you could solve it. And I'm saying that's the character of theory in a lot of biology, and that is that no one's going to come and tell you, okay, here's the question, try to solve it. What you have to do is you have to find an area where you think that there may be a question in there, and then you poke at it and see if you can find a question and an answer. And my intuitions are that there's a question in there, but I don't know what it is.
But it also could be that it's just...
Could be. And that would mean my intuitions were wrong, and that wouldn't be the first time. My intuitions can easily be wrong. That's not. But I'm just saying, for what it's worth, there's a very strong phenomenon. The fluctuation in synaptic strength, just 1 second, is much bigger than you get for LTP and LTD. It's a very big thing. It happens presumably in real life. There's no reason to think it doesn't happen in the animal as he's sitting there, although you can't quite do the experiment. But everything we know makes you believe that it probably is happening. And so there, what are the possibilities? One possibility is that each one of these mechanisms is used for something else, and it's not for anything. The other possibility is this is a complicated filter that is adjusting its characteristics depending on its history, and it's looking for something. So one thing you might do is you might sit and think about it and say, okay, what could it be looking for? How could I figure out what kind of theory could I make? So that would be figuring out what the question is, and then once you have the question, you could try to figure out the answer. And I'm just saying my intuitions are that there's a question there, but I have no evidence for that at all. Yeah.
An alternative would be to say that these are all physical constraints because of what the membrane has to do. And it has to respond and bring in molecules that are capable of.
I don't think so. See, facilitation is something that it has to go out of its way to do. It has to make a molecule that senses calcium in a way that has a much higher affinity than the calcium sensor for release, and has kinetics such that it doesn't come into play every time calcium comes in. So you have to have a calcium sensor in there that detects the calcium that's averaged over a period of time, that doesn't include, that doesn't just turn right on as soon as calcium comes in. That meant they went to a lot of trouble to do that. And sure, maybe it's just a side effect of something else, but I would say not. I mean, my intuitions would be not. My intuitions would be that there's some specific reason why that calcium sensor was put there in order to change release probabilities with this special time course. And there are many of these. There are at least three or four different time scales that facilitation-like phenomena happen over, and they have different mechanisms.
And they can be regulated.
Yes, and they can be regulated. So I figure that it's trying to do something. It's not just an epiphenomenon, but it might not be. Yeah.
So maybe I missed something. You said when you showed the data that you sort of waited for things to go into steady state, but animals don't work even in steady state.
Is there
some sort of novelty? I mean, this should be your question.
Yeah. Yeah. Presumably, it's looking for some sort of novelty. That's what I would guess. There's something that.
Or a mental question.
There's something. Yeah. There are a lot of experiments you can do, but when I say steady state, I didn't mean steady state with respect to the random spike, the natural spike train. I mean that we had it in a condition where we were stimulating with something that was totally different, a regular spike train. And then when you switch on the random spike train, it takes a while for it to settle. So that's coming into a steady state with respect to the random spike train relative to the one in the beginning, but that the steady one, the regular spaced one. But that's not the same. That's not to say that there's a steady state of some sort that's happening during this spike train. During the natural spike train. There may be temporal fluctuations in there that are constantly going on that are very important.
Okay. Small expression error.
Yeah. So, but the other, you made this comment, you answered also costs that if you just replace this by a Poisson train, which is one word, right, you get essentially the same result.
I'm
really looking for something that could identify a single variable.
No. If you replaced this with a Poisson spike train, you would get variability, a lot of variability. It would be in the same. It would be the same in the sense you get variability, but you wouldn't get the same variability as you get here, because this isn't a Poisson spike train. This is different. In fact, this is closer to a Poisson spike train, where you have a gated thing, where you have a Poisson parameter, that is in turn generated by a Poisson process. So you have something that goes up like this. So you have your rate constant, your lambda in the Poisson process, jump to a high level, stay there, jump down, and that's switched by a random telegraph signal. That's closer to what this is like, what the real spike train is like. And in fact, if you generate something like that and then play it into these synapses, it looks pretty much like. Yes, Barry.
You danced around this and I think you implied this, but I don't know if I answered it specifically, about the postsynaptic side.
Yes.
You have this beautiful scaling law. Everything scales together the size of the dot.
Yeah.
Is it true for the postsynaptic receptors as well?
I would think so. But people have not been able to detect it very well. So the evidence is that that it looks like the density of postsynaptic receptors is pretty constant. And so that would say if you had double the area, you'd have double the mini size. That's one. And the only piece of experimental information that I know is from Tim Murphy, who recorded postsynaptic calcium. And he found that he had bigger calcium flashes in synapses that had higher probabilities than other ones. This is calcium coming through NMDA receptors. But but in general, it has been claimed that there's no relationship. Actually, Tim Murphy in other contexts has claimed that there's no relationship between release probability and postsynaptic size. And the trouble is that it's so hard for individual synapses to find the release probabilities. It's hard to make a population of synapses where you know the release probability and you know for that particular synapse the size of the postsynaptic response.
What I'm wondering is how you reconcile all the recent beautiful work suggesting and showing postsynaptic number changes pretty dramatically.
Well, those experiments actually haven't shown that I know of that the number of receptors changes. What they've shown is that the rate of insertion changes, but they never measure the rate of removal. So as far as I know, no one has ever actually measured the number of postsynaptic receptors as a function of time. It's true that the turnover changes, for sure. It's known that the rate of insertion increases and the rate of removal also changes. That's known. But at an individual synapse, or even a population of synapses, I don't think anyone has ever measured the number of postsynaptic receptors as a function of time. And that I'd love to do it. I don't know how to do it. It's hard. I think we ought to have lunch? I think so. Okay, thank you.